The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield.
There is a school of thought that says if you believe something is going to happen, it'll happen. It's called manifesting. Not a passive process. Obviously, you've got to really work hard to make your dreams come true. There are some. I went online because I had a moment. And it says, you can make a vision board and start journaling and say positive affirmations. Those things in the movies where you see people saying, you are great and you are wonderful, you are great and you are wonderful. And eventually you believe it and you become great and wonderful. Yeah, Hollywood. The reality is, actually, that none of that's going to work for lowering interest rates. And I've been trying this for 2 years, by the way. Go down, go down, go down. Today, though, a big break. Maybe the manifesting is finally working. The ongoing worries about persistent and never-ending inflation seem to be softening. Not enough necessarily to bring interest rate cuts as soon as next week, but it could be a signal that the worst is over. Nicolas van der Vaart is the economist at the Bureau for Economic Research and with us this evening. Nicolas, welcome to The Money Show this evening. Just explain this concept of inflation expectations and why something like manifesting a belief is never going to work when it comes to what happens with the interest rate cycle. Just explain this idea of inflation expectations and why they're so important.
Good afternoon. Yes, indeed. So we do a survey among business people, trade unions, analysts, and households to get to know what they think inflation is going to be in future. And we call this inflation expectations. Now, the Reserve Bank, they use this survey and results to help inform their decision on interest rates. Now, the theory is that the inflation that people expect is one of the contributing factors into what actual inflation turns out to be. Because like trade unions, if they expect inflation is going to be high, then they demand higher wage increases for their members, for employees. And of course, employment is one of the biggest expenses for businesses. So if wages goes up a lot, then businesses have to increase their selling prices. So it becomes a cycle. So if inflation expectations is high, it can later translate into higher inflation itself. And then people want to demand or they expect maybe even higher inflation.
But is there a causal link between what we expect to happen and what does happen? Because you can ask people in a survey what you think, and I hope inflation is going to come down, so I might wish it down. I might say, I hope inflation comes down to 5%. And everybody else says, I also hope so. Then everybody says it. It doesn't necessarily make it come true, but it creates an environment in which you can begin to see a shift in attitudes towards inflation.
Yes, most definitely. The problem is just that we all always have two sides. We are buyers and sellers, even we employees. So we like to see inflation go down for what we buy, but what we sell our labor, there we would rather like to see high wage increases. So there's always this tension between the two. But in the theory, yes, the Reserve Bank would like to see inflation expectations go down because that helps for them in their forecast of inflation in future. And then they can lower interest rates because their mandate is for inflation to be around 4.5%.
Correct. So just because we believe it's going to happen doesn't mean that it's going to happen. It may happen at some point. Well, it is going to happen at some point in the future. Inflation eventually does get beaten lower. But just because inflation may be slowing, of course, it doesn't mean that prices are falling. They just go up more slowly. The Reserve Bank wants inflation to be anchored. Now, there's another technical term. Anchoring expectations. The governor talks about it all the time. And they want inflation to be anchored there or thereabouts 4.5%. And until they can get a sense of certainty that inflation will settle there or thereabouts, they're unlikely to start cutting rates, right?
Yes, very much so. They would like this inflation to be anchored around 4.5%. At this moment, it is still above 5%, so it is above their target. And our forecast sample, they expect inflation to be 5.4% this year, 5.3% next year, and 5.2% in 2026. So this is not really the ideal rate that the Reserve Bank would like to see, but it has been coming down, at least. It has been coming down.
Okay, as long as the trend is showing a decline, that'll give the Reserve Bank some comfort. But does this give you any sort of time frame then in which the Reserve Bank might be comfortable for cutting rates? We spoke to the governor last week, and he never says yes to a question, but he gives you a long explanation, which ultimately means no. Are you going to cut rates? No. Not soon, anyway. And I think he's going to stick to that mantra at next week's meeting and possibly the one or two after that, too.
Yes, we at the BER expect that the first interest rate cuts would only start towards in the second half of the year. So the Reserve Bank wants to be very sure that inflation has indeed come down and will remain low. If they start to hike to lower interest rates too soon, then inflation could pick up again. So they don't want to risk that. And they will, of course, also watch what's going on on the international scene. What's happening in America and in Europe.
Nicholas, thank you very much indeed. Nicholas van der Walt, economist at the Bureau for Economic Research, on the line to us. On to Darby Rettnow, economist at the Efficient Group. And Darby, just as the world is getting over its insane addiction for electric vehicles, and we're beginning to see cracks appear in the global electric vehicle market, where secondhand car sales are falling off a cliff because new car prices are coming down sharply thanks to lots of supply coming out of China, South Africa says, you know what we need to do? We need to start an electric vehicle industry in South Africa. Have we left this one too late, do you think?
Yeah, I think we are a little bit late. I think we should have started with this long time ago. South Africa has got a certain, we've got a well-established local motor car manufacturing industry. And it made sense, it would have made sense to start with this long, long time ago. And unfortunately, as you've said, is that many of the other manufacturers are already very, very well-established, and especially the Chinese are coming very, very aggressively into the market. So it's not going to be easy for South Africa to start competing internationally as well.
Because we've got a vibrant vehicle market, and it's East London, and it's Gqeberha, and it is Rosslyn and Pretoria, big motor manufacturers heavily incentivized to produce traditional internal combustion engine vehicles here. Big incentives being offered by government, and it should actually take off quite nicely, assuming we don't get any nasty political shocks in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, the incentives are very, very strong. And of course, we, the normal consumers, are paying very, very dearly for motor cars because of those incentives. Because basically it is, we are subsidizing the motor car industry in South Africa. So you're absolutely right. Those are really significant incentives that they will be getting. And I assume that the motor car industry will get a similar kind of incentives. Basically, what it means is that you pay a huge amount of import duty if you want to import a car, but if you export a car, then you get most of that money back. So that's the incentive. And in the process, the local motor car prices are quite high. But yes, the incentives are certainly there. Unfortunately for us in South Africa, I'm not so sure that we have necessarily all the technical know-how. I'm not so sure all the foreigners are going to run to South Africa to invest in South Africa because South Africa is far away, but perhaps even for political reasons as well. And the fact that you're going to be a little bit late in entering the market. So there are significant obstacles for South Africa to really, really make, I think, we'll be able to compete internationally. But yes, the incentives, without a doubt, the financial incentives are there. In fact, the Minister of Finance announced in the budget that they will give, he will allow 150% on capital deduction. Yes. So I mean, that is huge. And a part of that are the normal running incentives for motor car manufacturing as well. Like I've said, and I think it will be pretty much the same for electric vehicles as well.
It's important here too, because again, the moment you say anything negative about government industrial programs and electric vehicles and low carbon emissions in the future, people get very agitated, Darby. There is a very strong sense, however. I mean, the CEO of Hertz has lost his job because he went huge into electric vehicles, and Hertz has written down the value of 80% of its stock. It's sold off most of its electric vehicles because they're expensive to repair. They're expensive to replace the batteries, and demand for them, frankly, isn't nearly as good as was expected to be when the now former CEO of Hertz started making these massive multi-billion dollar investments. These transitions often happen very, very quickly and very excitedly with lots of noise and froth. And then reality sets in, and then there's almost like a pullback before you get to a more normalized growth path, isn't there?
Yeah, and in the case of South Africa, I think South Africa is a huge place. I don't think electric vehicles are going to take off soon. Me personally, I did buy an electric vehicle for my car, but I think in our personal case, we've got a lot of surplus electricity because of the solar panels that we've put on our roofs. So I think it can work in certain instances, but my wife uses the car only to go and pick up the kids and drive the kids around, so she never goes further than, say, 20, 30 kilometers or 40 kilometers a day. But if you really want to replace a normal internal combustion engine in places in big countries, like, for example, you need an additional infrastructure in the form of electricity or charging stations all over the place. I can't use my wife's motor car to go to Cape Town from Pretoria, as an example. It's simply not going to work because the infrastructure is not there. So I think in the case of South Africa, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah. Not yet. I mean, we've spoken to people who've got plans to put solar panels in place and to create charging stations, and it's all terribly ambitious and exciting. But yes, these things unfortunately manifest more slowly than we anticipate they will. But at the same time, if we don't set big, ambitious goals, Davi, one of the things that South Africa's become very bad at is becoming ambitious. We've become quite unambitious in recent years. We've got far too much PTSD from the Zuma years. We need a bit of confidence somehow. And this is, again, perhaps an element of confidence that Ibrahim Patel is finally introducing into the manufacturing sector.
Yeah, confidence is perhaps the biggest single obstacle if you look at the South African economy, because I just had a look at some confidence indices today, and the confidence in South Africa is very low. I think that is the first thing that we need to fix. But quite ironically, we want to manufacture electric cars in South Africa, but we do not have electricity, or certainly not enough electricity. And until we fix those sort of things and fix the railroads and the harbors and so on, those are the kind of things that we really need to fix before we can get any industry going in the country.
But you talk to the CEO of Ford, for example, and I love the story of the Ford Ranger, because the Ford Ranger's engine is made in England, and it's imported into the Ngqura port at Gqeberha in an unfinished state. It's put onto trains. It's railed all the way up to the Ford plant in Pretoria, where it's then filed down and made pretty and assembled. And then all of those vehicles are railed all the way back down to the Ngqura port, from which they're exported. And Ford Rangers remain a massive export revenue generator for Ford South Africa. It does work. It just could be so much better.
Yeah, but Bruce, just be honest about this. You know, if we you just explained how the whole thing is manufactured. We import a lot of stuff and we make it pretty in South Africa and assemble the whole thing and export it again. That doesn't sound very cost effective to me. I mean, if you subsidize an industry to the extent that we are doing in South Africa, by now there should not be any subsidies anymore. They should have been able to establish themselves properly and be able to compete internationally. They can't. They can't do it without the subsidy. So I'm not so sure it's such a huge success in the country.
It creates jobs. It creates downstream industries. Look, you'd be better at the calculations than I would on this one, Davi, in terms of looking at the extent of the subsidies and the economic impact of all of these incentives and what it really costs versus what is generated. And it does feel artificial. But at the same time, if we remove the subsidies, the players would go to Malaysia. They'd go to other parts of the world where incentives do exist. Can we afford to have that happen?
Well, perhaps South Africa should try to other industries where we can use all these masses of unemployed people in a country. Do we really need a motor industry? Maybe we can add value to agriculture, as an example. I think agriculture has got huge potential in South Africa. Maybe some other stuff. What about the mining industry? Can we add some value there? But we know we've got minimum wages in South Africa. We've got a problem with education in the country. We've got all sort of other issues. So maybe the answer to all of this is that we need to fix the things that we have to have control over. That means and the railroads and things like that, and just wait, and I'm sure the investors will come in whatever industry where they find where they think they will be making a success. The motor industry, although we are very, it seems to be working very well, we are creating in inverted commas a lot of jobs, and we are exporting a lot of stuff out of the country, and it is a foreign exchange earner. But I'm not so sure that's successful, because me and you, the average consumer in South Africa, is paying through our noses for cars, because we want to establish a very high-tech industry like the motor industry. It doesn't sound right to me.
Davi, thank you for your input this evening. Economist at the Efficient Group. And when Davi mentioned mining, I started giggling, because every single minerals, and we've had lots of them, they kept chopping and changing more often than I changed my socks during the Zuma era. But everyone, we must beneficiate mining minerals. We must beneficiate minerals. But you don't create the structures, you don't create the industry, you don't create the environment. And if you don't create the environment, you cannot thrive. Certainly created that environment for the motor industry. Is the motor industry incentive plan truly in the best interests of South Africa? That's a question being raised by Darby Ruit this evening.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Wayne McCurry from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank. It has been a week this week, Wayne McCurry, but I think the emerging markets sort of complex in pretty much the same leaky boat this week in terms of confidence.
Yes, I mean, we had a fantastic December, then we had a terrible January and February, then it perked up a couple of weeks ago quite nicely, the rand strengthened a little bit, and now we seem to be going back to the January and February syndrome that we had then of anything to do with an emerging market or a commodity-producing country is just bad news, and we just selling it.
It just feels like we've run out of a little bit of energy. We need some good news. Inflation expectations coming down, still not dramatic, but at least below 6%, you know, and could be lower. But there definitely is a change in tone in terms of Reserve Bank and what it has to work with.
And that will ultimately be the savior of our share market and maybe the savior of our economy as well. Lower interest rates are coming, which should lead to a commodity upcycle, which is good news for South Africa, for our share market, and for the rand. And the quicker that happens, the better. But of course, everyone thought it was going to happen quite quickly in December. Then it was pushed out. And, you know, maybe we'll hear a little bit more at the Fed meeting this week. They won't cut rates, but then maybe the verbiage will be a little bit more positive, then we'll go back to where we were in December. We're at this turning point of the cycle, and I've still firmly maintained that. But, of course, it's hard to say the cycle's going to turn when you're at the bottom, because at the bottom, there's no good news.
Yeah, and if you're Remgro, there's very little good news. Their earnings are 40%. Their businesses, they're restructuring their businesses. They've already told us in the past that they are operating in a really difficult environment. We'll chat to Yanni Durant in a moment. Do you see a better future now that they've rejigged the entire portfolio?
Well, they've rejigged everything in there. They're going for big unlisted investments. It's one of their drives. But maybe more importantly for Remgro, being an investment trust essentially, it's not the earnings, it's the net asset value or intrinsic asset value, which fell by 4%. And I think that was what pushed the share down. But the earnings itself are not as important as the net asset value.
Explain that, please, because this is an investment holding company. And these things, you know, they say that, the value is worth 100. And the stock market says, no, it's not. It's only worth 60. We're only prepared to pay 60 rand a share, even though you think it's worth 100. And that's where African Rainbow Capital finds itself, stuck and other investment trusts as well.
Many, many companies like that. Of course, if the directors on the valuation are right in the intrinsic value, it will eventually be realized either in cash flows or by separate listings or disposals of those companies.
True.
So eventually you work out whether that net asset value is correct or not. And it takes a bit of time, but eventually you do get there. You do actually realize, is this the true value, yes or no?
Wayne McCurry from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank. Thank you, Wayne, on what's been an otherwise quite quiet day for the JSE. We will chat to the Remgro Chief Executive, Yanni Durant, in a few minutes.
Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show. 6 to 8 p.m.
6 months ago, Remgro was telling us they were working in the toughest operating environment in their long history. Chief Executive Yanni Durant is with us. And looking at those results today, Yanni, with a 40% decline in earnings, there's a lot of restructuring, a lot of rearranging and refocusing of the business. But certainly some of that has got to be as a result of that tough environment you told us about 6 months ago.
Yes, good evening, Bruce. Absolutely correct. If you look through the results and you take out the restructuring costs, we're down nearly 12%, and that's not a performance we're proud of. Mainly related to two things, underperformance of our new company, Beineken Beverages, after we've merged with Distell, we didn't have a great 6 months, and then plus also the high interest rate environment that affected some of our companies that got debt levels. So it's not a great performance, and it's a very tough operating environment out there. We know that. I mean, the embedded costs in our system with load shedding, etc., water issues that we've got, it's actually, if you think about it, it's like an additional tax on our companies.
No, exactly right. I mean, the additional costs, the secondary plans you have to make, the restructurings that you have to do is an enormous distraction from growth and finding new opportunity. And there is a massive restructuring happening within the group, which we'll talk about in just a moment. The environment, which you told us 6 months ago that you'd never experienced it being worse, has it improved? Has it stayed the same? Has it deteriorated even further?
I think it probably stay the same, and I think what's happening now in the run-up to the elections, you know, we don't get many decisions that needs to be taken. I mean, we're talking about the deregulation of Eskom, the splitting it up into the generation units and so forth. So it's not getting easier, and no improvement. I mean, I can just give you one perfect example. We've been now nearly longer than 2 years on the approval of the Vodacom CIVH deal where they're going to invest in it, and we had to cut back on expansion into actually delivering internet services to the lower LSM group. So we could have been in some of these towns delivering bandwidth, high-speed internet at a very affordable price, but we had to cut back on it because we're not getting an approval for the deal until hopefully in May when we go to the tribunal. And it's not it's a detriment of our shareholders, a detriment of the country, 10,000 jobs that we promised that will be created. So it's just, at the moment, it's quite frustrating dealing with some of these red tape, I must to be quite frank.
I heard the minister and the presidency, Minister Ntshavheni, the other day saying it's not red tape, it's regulation. And it's a case of regulation is all well and good, but if it's efficiently managed and fairly administered and quickly done, then you get progress in economies, surely.
Absolutely. We just want certainty. If the answer is finally no, at least give it us like a year ago, then we can go on planning. But don't take procrastinate over decisions for 2-3 years. I mean, it's just impossible to do business. I mean, if a foreign company comes to invest and wait 2 years to get approvals, I mean, the frictional cost in the system is just tremendous. I mean, the people that are actually making the money are probably the lawyers here. And to be quite frank, but yeah, so it's but flippant on that, but yes, but that's the way sometimes we feel. So the cost, I mean, doing some of these deals, you could look at the once-off cost we had of restructuring our portfolio. It was exorbitant cost that we had to pay to get these deals through, and we're not finished yet with the journey. I mean, we still want to do this Vodacom deal.
There's a reason why they have the fanciest offices in town. There is a reason. I'm not sure what that reason is. Maybe it's the fees. The Mediclinic restructuring and the Mediclinic structure, of course, you've got new shareholders in Mediclinic. That's bedding down. The president, however, sitting with a very potentially damaging piece of legislation, NHI, on his desk. It's interesting that he's not signing it off in a hurry. He's in an election cycle. He's got an election coming up on the at the end of May, on the 29th of May. He is on the back foot politically. I'm wondering if he's waiting for an opportune moment to sign this thing into law and fight the battle after the election with business, which has threatened to take the matter to court, of course.
I think, I mean, without a doubt, I mean, business and society, and we will definitely take it to court on the constitutionality of that because it takes away choice. So that will definitely happen. To be quite frank, I don't think how they can afford NHI. I mean, if you look at countries like Switzerland and you look at the NHS in the UK, it's actually unaffordable service levels gets down. So you take it down to the worst denominator in terms of service levels and things like that. I mean, the biggest medical aid, from a private point of view, James, the government employees, they're all on private insurance. Imagine if they now have to start queuing. I mean, our service delivery will even get worse if they have to start queuing at normal public hospitals. So
I've never understood why government has been so adamant on NHI when there is such a potential downside risk to government employees being thrust into the public system as a result of medical aids not functioning in the way that we've become used to it. RCL, moving chicken out of the portfolio, it's a de-risking exercise. We spoke to RCL about this a couple of weeks ago. It feels like this has been probably the most momentous year in Remgro's evolution in many, many years, just in terms of repositioning and re-engineering and reshaping the portfolio of Remgro. Are you close to conclusion? Will there ever be a conclusion in terms of the structure of a business like Remgro?
I think life is a journey and a business is a journey, so there's never going to be a completion. But we're actually very happy and proud of what we've achieved so far. We still need to complete the Vodacom one. But yeah, I think it's you're absolutely right. It's been a transformative year, 12 to 18 months that we've done it. Unfortunately, we had to do it in a very, very difficult operating environment as well as we know load shedding, regulatory red tape, regulatory frictional cost. I mean, consumer under very much stress, high interest rates. So, but we just said we'll do it and we'll continue with it. It's not binary. So I think we've positioned the company for the future, and operating in a private environment versus a listed environment of some of our companies is going to give us a lot more agility. We've got good shareholders on board on Mediclick that actually understand the Swiss operating environment. So I think we've positioned the portfolio well for the future. These short-term 6 months hiccups that we've got with Heineken and things like that, I mean, we look past it and we're optimistic that we will actually come out at the other end much better.
It's at times like this where there is deep distress in an economy, where assets become a lot cheaper, where the potential for acquisition presents itself. And we've seen through many cycles in South Africa's history where entrepreneurs have gone, that's too good a deal to turn down, I have to buy it. I'm wondering if you are in that space or whether you are, you know what, we've got a nice diversified portfolio, we don't need any more in it, and whether your attention is shifting elsewhere in terms of growth.
I think you're absolutely right. These types of environment present itself opportunities, so we continuously looking. That's what we paid for. So we're checking out the environment. We think we can do some bolt-on acquisitions at the right price, which is much more reasonable than a few years ago. But we must just be cautious not to overpay. But, I mean, Remgro, as we sit here, we've got a strong balance sheet. We've redeemed in the period under review most of our debt. So we've got actually more cash on the balance sheet than most companies. So we've got a very strong balance sheet that we can execute on some of these opportunities. But we'll look at it, but in a very responsible way.
Yanni Durant, the chief executive of Remgro, clear frustration. I mean, clear frustration. And the trouble is with being outspoken in an environment where you are regulated by government. Government gets cross. And you'll see sort of, I think, quite robust feedback on the Yanni Durant interview this evening. And yeah, the difficulty of operating in an unsupportive environment. It is very, very difficult indeed. Chief Executive of Remgro, Yanni Durant, share price down 4% on the day after a disappointing decline in earnings. And no excuses, but yeah. In any business, getting your distribution rights absolutely pivotal. If you can't get your product to your customers, to your market really, really quickly, and if you can't do it effectively and especially cost effectively, then you're dead in the water. Great logistics can make or break you. And I think we've learned that more than ever since COVID and the breakdown in global logistics. It's been a very significant factor. It was also been a very significant factor around the world, isn't a trend that Naspers noted many years ago, and that is in deliveries. I'm still not a big fan of fast food deliveries and things. I don't think you get optimal product in your hands on the receiving end. We've done experiments with getting a burger from Sandton City to our Sandton studios. I think one took 45 minutes. Greasy, cold, not very nice. But I was interested to see Norman Goodfellows acquire what they call a significant stake in Port to Port. Port to Port is a platform that was created by Niccolo Pudel and has been facilitating wine deliveries in several markets. Niccolo is with us on the line to us from Germany this evening. I'm not sure when you started. It feels like more than 10 years ago. It probably feels like more than 20 to you, Niccolo, but I think it's been quite a slog, hasn't it?
Yes, that's correct. Hi, Bruce. How are you doing?
No, very good. Very good. I'm interested in the deal. Tell me more.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, it's been a deal in the making. I mean, you know, we've spoken for the last 10 years a couple of times. First time when Michael Jordan invested, and then when we opened in the UK. And we were not looking necessarily for a new partner, but when the option came about of NGS and when I met Jason, it was just a match made in heaven. It was strategically for us exactly what we were looking for. An established business.
What does the tie-up mean? I mean, how does it work practically? Here you are with international ambitions. You're in Germany. You've got a business in the UK. There is a business in South Africa. And I'm not sure just how actively South Africans order their wine virtually. Why does this tie-up make sense to you?
Well, our core market remains South Africa. It's where the largest number of our catalog is, all our vendors are there, and the team is based in South Africa. And for us, it's a great moment because there's been some consolidation in the online space, Few players have either closed down or have merged on the lower end. And in the premium space, for us, NGF was the one option that made a lot of sense for us to go and tackle the liquor stores and go and become a challenge for the online supermarkets. So I'm very much focused. I live between the two countries, actually, and we're very excited for this, yeah.
Fantastic, Niccolo. Congratulations. Thank you for chatting this evening. Jason McAvoy, Chief Executive at Norman Goodfellows. Have you been looking at, I don't know, the Checkers 60-60 bikes with envy and thinking, I want to get into that business. I want to be delivering Bollinger in the back of a scooter to my customers. What's your motivation here, Jason?
Well, I wasn't comfortable with anything we did on the scooter with a naked lady on the back of it. So we're quite keen to up the level of class in alcohol deliveries. On a more serious note, the port-to-port team and the port-to-port experience is first-class online. I think no one does it better in South Africa, or certainly in the liquor space. So we've got a lot to learn from them that will help us on our website. We can supply like a vendor to them, where we can shorten that delivery time to same day, Durban, Cape Town, KZN, and probably even Garden Route, where we've got a warehouse. So being able to get the basket delivered same day makes a big difference to the customer offering, as well as to expanding maybe some expansion on the wine side, but certainly significant expansion on the spirit side.
Is this bigger than sorting out just your own distribution? Because, of course, one, you get a system that allows you, without building new stores in George and Neisner, for example, or in Klebercha or in Buffalo City, it allows you to get access to markets that perhaps you as Norman Goodfellows would have cost a lot more and be a lot more complicated and a lot required you to carry a lot more stock in order to deliver.
So the opportunity outside of major metros, I think, is fairly limited. And you both port-to-port numbers and Norman Goodfellows numbers, it shows that. I think the opportunity is significantly improving service offering and breadth of offering in the major metros.
And then I suppose some booze. Amazon is coming to South Africa. They're going to be fighting amongst themselves. They no doubt will deliver some booze as well. Possibly not the range of brands, the level of brands that you are doing. And so it's quite a big confidence step, isn't it, in terms of in a very competitive online environment to be going to war with some fairly big guys?
Well, two things. Firstly, I think Amazon is coming with unlimited budget, and they're coming, and that is big. But I think more scary to take a lot than it would be to us. And I think it'll take 2 years for them to get to anything meaningful in the market. But I think much like the port to port is a bespoke offering, Normal Goodfellows is a destination offering. And although the World Wide Web is not destination, we think that the customers who find either port to port or Normal Goodfellows are looking for something that they're not going to find somewhere else. So when it comes to range, competitive pricing, and service, very high service levels, the big guys don't quite play like that, I don't think.
Chief Executive at Norman Goodfellows, Jason McAvoy, and Niccolo Podell, Chief Executive at Port to Port. It's been around for quite some time, last decade or so, getting some good investment in. Core focus of the business still very much in. Jeff Bezos, of course, has made an absolute fortune and had to give a big chunk of it away to McKinsey when they divorced. He continues to make a huge amount of money out of Amazon Web Services. So much money, in fact, that he's been able to go into space on one of the first ever privately funded space flights. He now is putting millions of dollars into the Bezos Earth Fund. It's making a big investment into alternative meats. Brett Thompson is co-founder and chief executive of New Form Foods. You're in this space of the new generation, I suppose, kinder meats industry, cultivated meats. This is where you take cells from animals and you grow meat rather than take, I don't know, a brinjal and turn it into a rump steak, Brett Thompson. It's quite encouraging that somebody like Jeff Bezos is putting big bucks into this industry.
Yeah, Bruce, thanks very much for having me. It's definitely a good sign, and I think it kind of speaks to where we are. I think in the beginning, as you mentioned, 5-10 years ago, there's a lot of hype within plant-based, particularly, and then also with cultivated meat, which is what we're up to. And after a while, some investors started getting, where's my returns, where are things happening? And when money's not coming, or money's only coming from a venture capital source, it puts a lot of pressure on industry to actually, you know, deliver immediately. Whereas what Bezos is doing and what others are doing is actually providing some other source of funding, which is actually coming from a philanthropic version, which allows for biotech, which has got a longer cycle of development, to be able to flourish a bit more before we have to get to market. So that's roughly where I see it and where we are at the moment.
Where are you in terms of this path? Because I think you're choosing the more difficult route, aren't you?
Yes.
This is
look,
deeply deeply scientific process that you're undertaking here to, one, produce the product, and two, to get people to accept that this is as good as the original, for want of a better term.
I think consumers tried meat alternatives over the last 20 or 30 years, and there's definitely that experience. Some call it the bad tofu experience. You know, they've had that product, it's been 20 years, and like, where's the improvements? And what we are seeing right now is sort of a meat 2.0 version, a plant-based version 2.0, which you're seeing in plant-based. But cultivated is essentially trying not to make a brinjal into a steak, which I think would be pretty hard anyway. But what we really are trying to do
I couldn't think of enough pulses. They take me a different thing. Brinjal's the first thing that leapt to mind. But yes,
I think
it was making
No, it's correct. And I think some people would say, well, I'll just eat the brinjal. But there's a lot of people, a lot of consumers that aren't happy with the current meat alternative crops. And yes, cultivated meat is a far more difficult, far more capital intensive process. But there's a couple of things that we've done as a company to try and deviate away from relying on such big CapEx expenditure and move to market a lot quicker through the licensing of technology, opposed to relying just on producing the product. And the crucial component of this is actually working with meat and or the meat and food industry themselves. And I think that's where us and others in our industry are saying, these guys have been working on this for three thousands of years, but definitely in the industrial age, they've been able to perfect the distribution and manufacturing of meat. What we're trying to provide is something within the value system that can essentially optimize it and produce meat in a way that, well, I think is far more resource and efficient, and has also got the benefits, particularly environment, and that's why Bezos is getting involved, but also from the likes of animal welfare, and those issues have been highlighted quite quickly when there's a ship arriving in the shores of Cape Town. You know, so I think these are all sort of pressure points, but definitely getting involved with a licensing of technology to the industry itself, it has been our approach, and we've been able to go to market a lot quicker because of it.
Are you in production? I mean, if I went into an organic shop or into a specialist shop, would I find a new form food steak in a package on a shelf?
Not just yet. So regulatory environment does require some changes and some work to be done. That's still a bit of an ongoing conversation that we've already initiated with South African regulators. There is some movement in the UK and the US on this front. But in terms of production, there is still quite a capital requirement to get to a level of production where you might be seeing it on shelf. Again, production for retail takes a little bit longer, and there's a bit more heavier regulatory environment that we have to navigate, while something along the lines of food service is probably where you're going to see us first. So, and it probably wouldn't be new form because we'd be white labeling it, but we're hoping to be able to get production at that stage within the next 18 to 24 months. But as I said in the beginning, we've only been doing it for a few years, and the technology is difficult. I mean, we are going after something which is difficult, but it's got, I think, a far better reward at the end of the day, and not only for consumers, but for retailers and hopefully investors as well.
I think GMO gets a rough deal. I don't think people appreciate the benefits of genetically modified crops, for example, and just how you can make crops more drought-resistant, pet-resistant, capable of delivering higher yields and therefore sustaining a booming global population. I do think that there is a lot of misinformation around GMO. Not all GMO is bad, not all GMO probably is good. But when it comes into when you are Frankensteining meat, for want of a better term, is there a concern that you're going to have to cross that hurdle of public acceptance where people want a product that tastes as good as the original, that feels as good as the original, that is as nutritious as the original, but kind of feel a little bit skeptical that, yes, it's grown from real meat cells, but has it changed the chemical structure, if you like, of the product?
It's look, I mean, dealing with the consumer, that's key with us. And that's, again, why we're working with larger companies who know their consumer a lot better than we do. But I think from a South African perspective, there is encouraging information that there's research that's been done over the years that seems to suggest that at least more than half of South Africans would be willing to try the product when it became available. I do think there's a lot of work that our industry at an international level has to do to change perceptions and educate and provide awareness. And I think a lot of people kind of still have this perception of a petri dish, which at scale, it's not. It really looks like a brewery of what we're trying to create that is producing the meat at scale. So there's a combined effort that has to happen as an industry, but then also being able to produce enough product so that more people can try it and it tastes good. It is not genetically modified, but to your point, I'm also sort of, you know, I would say there's a role for GM foods in the future for a growing population, but at the moment we don't. There's also encouraging signs, I think, from certain areas in the world where maybe not all of Europe, but definitely parts of Europe are opening up to GM and new novel foods. You're seeing some pushback, but on the same time, you're seeing a lot of companies and countries rather looking to endorse this because of the need for food security from protein because of the requirement that conventional animal agriculture needs at the moment.
And I mean, I don't know how much time you spent in feedlots. They're not happy places. The ship with all the cattle on it in the Cape Town harbour the other day demonstrated again the issues with the global trade in animals. I mean, it was an appalling and necessary revelation. Andy Jarvis, who's the director of the future food business within the Bezos Earth Fund, says that, you know, these alternatives need to cost less and they need to be more flavorful. And maybe more flavorful is positive. Is possible in the short term. Certainly when it comes down to cost, the amount of money that's getting invested and has to be invested in research and development and creation means I'm not too sure that, you know, sort of lab-grown meats are going to be any cheaper anytime soon, if ever.
Yeah, I mean, look, so let's look at the market of this. The lab-grown or cultivated meat industry has received about $3 billion in 10 years, which sounds like a lot, but it's not a lot if you compare it to a $1 trillion enterprise, which is the current meat industry, which has received significant amounts of support through subsidies, et cetera, over the years, and has created these CAFOs, these intensive agricultural lots that we were sort of witnessed with the recent ship example. So we're up against it, definitely, but there's a lot of investors that are starting to see that this is a growing market and that there's an ability to provide 2.0, something a bit better than what we've seen. When it comes to cost, look, it is a crucial thing. I mean, there are, at the moment, cultivated meat is vastly too expensive. And I won't break it down too much, but the main thing is what we feed the cells. If we're able to reduce, that's about 89% of the cost. Because what we've been doing is trying to take things that are utilized in traditional pharmaceuticals and trying to make them food grade. And we've been able to achieve that significantly over the last 2 years, but it's still a long way to go. So once you're able to get that cost down significantly, that's your first step. And then it's the actual engineering. So it's what do you put it in? Now, as I said, a brewery, they're pretty conventional there. You can get them, they're pretty costly. You can buy them off the shelf almost these days. But we have to make it a bit more bespoke to what our tissue culture needs. So it does require a lot of capital, but over time, it's a $3 billion investment can be played off quite quickly. I mean, there's ways that we've been able to do it again. I mean, we work out of a space in Woodstock, which is called Uvu Bio. That's kept our costs down significantly. It's partially funded by the South African government, amongst others. So there are ways that you could look at this in a way that's cost effective, but it is a challenge, and we've got ways and thoughts at how we will achieve it over the next 18 to 24 months as we move to closer to a market.
Our Signals feature this evening, Brett Thompson. Thank you, Brett. Fascinating. Co-founder and chief executive at New Form Foods. It was called Mzansi Meat. They've rebranded. And, of course, the uphill struggle of finding alternatives for what is going to be an increasingly hungry population into the future, a discerning population into the future, in a world where there's less and less space to do agriculture the old-fashioned way.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
Our Africa Business Report is brought to you by SAA, celebrating 90 years, connecting dreams, bridging continents and soaring higher. Ronak Gopoldas is Director and Africa Analyst at Signal Risk this evening. What is happening in the myriad of elections around the world? We've seen the outcome of what they called the election in Russia. We've seen, I think, Pakistan, India's going to elections, the US, the UK, South Africa. Right now in Senegal, there is an important election playing out as well.
Yeah, absolutely, Bruce. Finally, Senegal is going to the presidential polls after a build-up that was shrouded in a lot of controversy. Your listeners will know that historically in the West African region, Senegal has been one of the most stable democracies. But in recent time, the political climate has really become quite tense. And that's really on the back of the recent crisis triggered by Macky Sall's decision to postpone the presidential election for really flimsy reasons on February the 3rd. So that provoked a real strong pushback from opposition and civic groups. Ultimately, the decision was vetoed by the Constitutional Council. And now Senegal is going to the polls on Sunday. And this election, it was ordered, has to happen before April 2, which is the end of the second five-year term of Macky Sall. Just some background for your listeners. The tensions in Senegal had been building for a number of years over the increasingly authoritarian behavior and regressive democratic behavior of Macky Sall, who had used the legal system and political means to disqualify opposition candidates from running. There was speculation around a third term for him. So it's good that we're finally getting some clarity, and we'll move on to a new chapter in the Senegalese political dispensation. Now, if you're an investor, the three things that I would be watching are the following. So is it going to be a first-round electoral victory or a runoff? And there are 19 candidates in this presidential field, so it's going to be quite complicated. And the way the Senegalese electoral code works is that a candidate requires a 50+1 majority. Otherwise, it goes to a second round of voting with the two best-performing candidates. Then the second question is around the credibility of the polls. And yeah, given the fact that this has kind of been done on a very haphazard basis, the logistical constraints over Ramadan, the fact that up until last week, one of the candidates was in prison, that is, you know, going to compromise the credibility of the polls a little bit. And then the policy direction, you know, are we going to get the continuity candidate or the opposition candidate? And are we going to get a more left-leaning, more radical policy dispensation? So lots to play for in the Senegalese elections on the weekend.
All of these elections just feel that much more fraught now. I mean, they're very clear, polarized sort of sides happening in elections, and perhaps more clarity, therefore, and greater choice for voters. They've just got to get out, like here, and vote. Egypt, full of potential, full of excitement. You know, we had the big Arab Spring, of course, massive restructuring of Egypt, its economy, its leadership, some currency volatility recently. What's up happening in that very, very big and important economy, one of the three biggest, of course, on our continent?
Yeah, it's a couple of weeks ago, it was just really a crazy week in Egypt around the 6th of March, where the authorities resorted to shock and awe tactics to try and address some of the big economic concerns that you've highlighted. For the better part of the last 2 years, the economy has been in the doldrums. Inflation has remained very high. The currency is under pressure. There have been forex shortages. And now with the conflict in Gaza and the Red Sea crisis, that's really affected tourism and the Suez Canal receipts. So Egypt's economy needed some serious intervention, and authorities threw the kitchen sink at the problem. So they hiked rates 600 basis points in one intervention. And this came after a 200 basis point hike earlier in February. And that is obviously a remedial measure to bring down inflation, which was hovering around 30%. In the same vein, they reduced currency controls and allowed the currency to devalue. So it lost around 60% of its value, which is obviously terrible for consumers and for companies with FX exposure because of the inflationary impact. But what it's done is that it's created positive sentiments in financial markets, starting to attract the hot money and the portfolio flows back. And this combination of factors, I think, is really positive for markets. And then in the same week, Egypt kind of tied up its staff level agreement with the IMF for funding. And this is something that's been in the works since 2022. It's an anchor. It sends a signal to markets as well. And when you combine this with the massive deal that they've signed with the UAE for $35 billion, you know, I think it addresses some of the funding issues and again highlights Egypt's regional importance. It's too big to fail. It's a key mediator in this current conflict between Israel
and Hamas. It's an anchor in the region and a very important economy. So things looking a bit better in Egypt.
Good. We know that we've been greylisted. We've been on the greylist, I think, for 2 years now. The Reserve Bank governor's expressed confidence that we're ticking the boxes we need to tick. And he suggested we may be off the greylist by this time next year, or certainly by some point in 2025. Kenya and Namibia embarking on the same sort of process.
Yeah, unfortunate that they've also been greylisted as of last month. You know, we're no strangers to it, as you mentioned. And the impact of greylisting is significant. So first of all, you encounter reputational damage. Doing business in your country comes with a higher risk premium, additional admin and bureaucracy because of checks and regulations, drives up the cost of doing business. And then there's, of course, a risk premium that's assigned to you as well. You know, just looking at the data from the IMF, greylisting often results in an average decline of capital inflows of nearly 8% of GDP. Corresponding banking is affected. External receipts are affected as well. Trade volumes in the banking sector. So not great for the economy in either of these countries. But, you know, there is a success story that we can refer to. You know, in 2020, Mauritius was greylisted. And within 2 years, the country turned it around. And I think there are a few lessons that we can potentially learn as South Africa, as Kenya, and as Namibia. And the first of those is that coordination between the private sector and government is very important in order to turn things around. The second is collaboration between supervisory and regulatory agencies. The Bank of Mauritius, the Financial Services Commission, the Financial Intelligence Unit, all kind of put all hands on deck to come up with a plan to remedy the situation. And then on a third level, there needs to be a high-level political commitment and political will. And Mauritius kind of drove this through the office of the Prime Minister, which really accelerated its exit from the grey list. So not great news, but an opportunity to really clean up and provide more transparency if used effectively for both Kenya and Namibia.
Ronak, thank you very much indeed. Director and Africa analyst at Signal Risk this evening with our Africa. Now, imagine if you could build the life that you want to live, rather than a life that demands that you work all hours of the day and night, that you never have enough time to enjoy the fruits of your labor because you're simply too busy because you've got this nagging and persistent fear that you won't have enough money to last you through your lifetime. And if you missed my discussion a couple of weeks ago with the astonishingly aspiring Catherine Hodgson, the chief executive of the Hodgson Group, please find it and listen to it alongside this discussion. It's a wonderful example of what I hope I can illustrate with Nicole van der Munkhoff this evening, who's a certified financial planner from Independent Securities. Catherine Hodgson, many years ago, probably 3 decades ago, I don't want to age her at all, but Catherine Hodgson, a while back, left corporate life because she wanted more say over her career, more flexibility to make her own choices around when and how to have children, and where and when she should put her energy rather than being at the behest of a very successful corporate career. At the time, if memory serves, in a multinational cosmetics company, which required lots of to-ing and fro-ing and traveling, and she loves traveling. But she wanted to do it on her own terms. And you can listen to all of the detail of that yourself. But here she is 3 decades later with a business that she oversees but is run by others, where she is able to fulfill her ambition of mentoring and helping others grow and develop all over the world, but also where she spends 5 months of the year. And this, if you missed it, may make you a little sick. So brace yourself. Where she spends 5 months of the year sailing in the Mediterranean, working when she has to from a boat, which she and her husband own, and living her version of a dream life. Nicole van der Munkhoff, of course, is with us this evening.
Good evening, Bruce. Unfortunately, I missed a little bit of your introduction, so I really only caught the tail end of it. so if you don't mind just running through it again for my sake, just so I know where we're jumping
in. You see. Now, let's go back to the beginning. No, I won't. Yes. I interviewed a very nice lady called Catherine Hodgson, who for the last 3 decades has built a family business and has given herself the freedom in the space. And she and her husband, we don't like them, but they spend 5 months of the year on a yacht in the Mediterranean, occasionally working, mostly sailing, I think having the occasional drink and hosting friends on the boat. But she's cultivated and created very deliberately a lifestyle which has been funded by hard work and very careful planning beyond the traditional put away 10 or 15% for your pension one day.
Yes, and she's definitely living the aspirational lifestyle, I think, that we all only dream of, and it feels as if it's very unattainable for a lot of us. And it's, as you say, it's very deliberate, and she's made a lot of deliberate decisions. And I think that's the core of our discussion this evening, is to be deliberate.
Explain then. How? I mean, we're sitting in our jobs, we're earning a nice salary. It's not enough to get us the boat in the Med. And we have to start making, I suppose, some choices. Probably earlier is better in terms of getting some corporate experience, perhaps, and then going out and creating the thing that is going to make it possible. But how do we even begin to contemplate the Hodgson effect? Let's give it a name.
Yes. So I suppose the opposite of the Hodgson effect is, for a lot of people, the reality is that they kind of wake up just before retirement, and then they realize, okay, I now need to kind of determine what kind of lifestyle can my retirement actually fund. And that's really starting at the back end of the equation. So it's really looking at what are your goals, what do you want to achieve, and doing lifestyle financial planning around that. So trying to determine if I want to do the following things, here are my goals listed. What do I need to do? How do I need to plan for those goals to ensure that I can actually meet those goals?
Yes. And I remember the first time I ever sat opposite a financial advisor, it said, what are your goals? And I went in the back, are you stupid? I want lots of money. And it was, I didn't ask how he's stupid, but I think it was written on my face. It was like, well, I want lots of money. And again, I don't know if at 25 you can set realistic goals.
Because
at that point are, don't get involved in a car crash if you've had too big a party, and, always make sure you can afford an Uber. When is it realistic to create goals rather than dreams? Because, yes, we all dream of the life that Catherine and her husband have built. It's not possible for everybody. In fact, it's possible only for a minority of people. So how do we set realistic goals, and when do we start setting those goals?
So I think trying to encompass, all of your aspirations and the timeline for achieving them is very daunting, as you say. My worst is if you're sitting in some form of a corporate development seminar and someone says to you, give you a piece of paper and you have to write down your goals for the seminar, your goals for life. It's always daunting for me. And I think a lot of people shut down when we say the word goals. So before we've lost anyone online, I think starting small, but starting with important. So what are the important goals? For a lot of people, that's becoming debt-free, or it's paying off debt. It's paying for children's education. It's as simple as retirement. They want to retire quite comfortably. And then it's about being realistic about what's the root of those goals. So what's the brass tacks behind those goals? What's that goal going to cost you? So in today's term, what's a reasonable amount of money that you want to spend or that you are willing to spend on that goal? If it's education, for example, for children, are you looking at private education? Are you looking at local? Are you looking at tertiary? All of those have different numbers linked to them, and it's determining what is the goal, but what is the monetary value of that goal. And once we know that, then we can have a look and say, okay, so how do I get to eventually having enough money to earmark to pay for that goal, essentially?
We're talking to Nicole von der Munkhoff, who is a certified financial planner from Independent Securities. How do you create realistic lifestyle planning? This isn't just financial planning. This is bigger. It's beyond just a rands and cents decision or pounds, shillings and pence decision. It is a decision as to how you want to live your life. And by being deliberate about the decisions that you make and as early as you can make them, you stand a far higher chance of getting favorable outcomes rather than being a little bit fluffy and a little bit woolly and a little bit vague. And I believe that Nicole has an acronym, which she's going to introduce to us in just a moment.
Yes. So it's definitely not my acronym.
No, Nicole. In a moment, Nicole.
Oh, in a moment. Sorry, Bruce.
That was a cue to pause. In a moment with Nicole.
The Money Show. Personal Finance.
Nicole von der Munkhoff is our guest this evening, certified financial planner at Independent Securities. So we want to be deliberate. We want to take actions. We want to make sure that we can get positive financial outcomes in our lives. Nicole, how do we begin to skin this cat? Don't say that. The SPCA gets cross. How do we... SPCA. We don't want to skin cats. How do we begin to eat this elephant? No, we don't eat elephants. How do we begin this process?
Okay. So the very first thing, I think, is just to understand what your current position is. So you need to understand where you are. And that means, you know, being very honest about what are your assets, what are your liabilities, what's your income, and then ultimately, what are you actually giving out on a monthly basis? Because we've said it often on your show, Bruce, you know, you need to pay yourself first, essentially. So you need to make sure that you're saving effectively. So if you don't understand those things as a starting point, you know, you're not going to know where to go. So you need to know where you are now to know where you want to go. Then, as we said earlier, is about goal setting. So although it is a daunting task, there is an acronym that can help. My first advice is always start with your biggest and most important. So as you plan, and nothing happens in a vacuum. So you're never going to be able to plan for these individual events. My experience is we have a look and we say, well, what's most important? And we kind of start building the plan from there. And the plan is almost like a layered cake where, you know, we add a new layer on as our goals expand, essentially. So how do you set goals? There's an acronym by George Doran from 1981, so it's quite an old acronym, but he came up with just be smart about it. So you want to be specific. So be specific. You want to retire comfortably. What does that mean for you? It must be measurable. So there must be some form of a value that must be linked to that. And just think of it in today's terms. In today's terms, what would you actually need to live off of when you retire? How much do you think? And that goes to lifestyle. So what do you want to do? What are the kinds of activities that you imagine yourself? You know, is it playing golf 3 times a week? Is it sailing on a yacht? What does that look like? And then make it achievable. So achievable is, you know, it needs to be things that are realistic, things that you will be able to do. So, you know, saying you want to become the King of England, that's not achievable. It's not going to work. But make it relevant to yourself.
Your goal doesn't have to be, I want to sail on a yacht in the Med for 5 months of the year. Maybe you want to go camping once a year over Christmas for a month without being disturbed. Whatever the goal is, it doesn't have to be outrageous, outlandish, and unachievable. It has to be achievable and it has to be real, because the moment you set an unrealistic goal, you're never going to make the sort of progress that is going to provide you with the motivation to keep you engaged and involved and continuing to invest, because you go, well, it's never going to be achievable. Oh, this was a terrible idea. I'm not doing it anymore, sort of thing.
And more than likely it's going to put mental pressure on you, because it's going to be, you know, you're going to feel like you're chasing your own tail. The other important thing is that it should be time bound. So there should be a time limit. You know, I want to start scaling down when I'm 65, or when I'm 60, or when I'm 70, or, you know what, I'm never going to scale down. I love what I do. I have the opportunity to work for as long as possible. So I'm going to carry on with that, but I'm going to take more breaks. So I'm going to go for 4 months of the year and work less, or whatever the case may be. And then it's important, once you've got these goals and you've kind of set the big ones, so I'd say choose your three big ones. Start there. And then it's about matching your current position to those goals. So what financial implications will your goal have in the future? And how can you align your current financial position to ensure that those goals are achieved? What you're trying to really ascertain is your current financial position and trajectory adequate to actually sustain the goals that you want to ultimately achieve?
And again, keeping everything relevant and actually setting time frames. And I think we are bad at setting time frames, and I think we're bad at setting targets and goals. I mean, again, you don't like the use of the word goals, but you've got to be able to have measurable time frames.
Yes, definitely. And I think time is something one of my friends said to me. I was very surprised this year her kid went to grade one, and I was like, I don't know where time's gone. I remember when this kid was born. And she said to me, time for her has become this thing where weeks go slowly, but years go quickly. And I think that that happens to all of us as we get older in life, is it runs away with us. And before we know, you know, life happens when you're making other plans, kind of thing. We have a tendency to set these things out, and that is not the idea. Something else that's important for me as well is just to use realistic assumptions. We can make all our goals achievable if we set unrealistic assumptions. So we need to be realistic, not only in our time frame, but also in how we approach this. So are we going to assume, you know, you're going to get double-digit returns on your investments every year? Because more than likely, you won't get that every year. Some years, you might even get negative returns on those investments. So the money you're putting away, 1 year might not work for you as hard as in the next year. And are you being realistic about that? Are you being realistic about what 1 rand will be worth when you reach retirement in however many years that may be? And that's very important, because, you know, painting a rosy picture is very easy. But I think it's about being realistic about the path that you want to take and that you ultimately need to take.
But it all starts, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step, and nothing happens by itself. And, you know, when you talk to people and they say, oh, my dream, and you want to say, it's not a dream, it's a goal, it's an ambition. And if you're going to sit there going dreaming and scrolling on other people's fake lives on Instagram and want to live their lives and so busy being distracted by the excitement and the joy and the opportunity and then going out with your friends and sharing your dreams and you all talk to each other about how you deserve this, that's all lovely. But until you take action, until you act, until you put a system and a process in place that is going to force you to actually put cold, hard cash down to facilitate that dream, you're going to be sitting there at 65 going, you know, I had a dream. I had, you know, and you can write songs about it, or, you know, make speeches about it, but you the chance would have passed you by.
Yes, and instead of saying, well, you know, this is the kind of lifestyle my retirement savings is going to buy me, and it's exactly what I wanted, you're going to be sitting on the other side of that spectrum where you're going to say, well, this is kind of all I've had to show for my steady 40, 50 years of hard work, and now I have to make my lifestyle fit into this picture. And I think, you know, be aspirational about it. And as you say, the difference between a dream and a goal is really taking that first step. And often the first step is the hardest.
And consistency and persistence and, you know, reviewing the stuff all the time, but also realizing, yes, and it's something I'm going to pick up with Warren later. Somebody emailed me today just to say, oh, I've left it all too late and there have been divorces and it's all just been a horrible mess. And now I'm frantically scrambling. And he says, you know, if we can just land one message, it's never too late to start. And this is a guy who's older than I am, been in business for a long time, well-respected, but it's just had been very distracted by being busy and, you know, life hasn't worked out the way he would have hoped it would work out. And it's had huge negative impacts. And so, you know, control what you can as early as you can and maintain some consistency.
Exactly. And I think it's about, as you say, one, it's starting early. Two, it's realizing that, you know, things change and things change often quickly, you know, where you now need to pivot. So once you've got this plan and you've thought up three goals, that's not the end of the process. It's a continual process and it's continually looking back and looking forward to say, well, you know, and all the things that I initially said, what I wanted. If your life has changed and you've gotten divorced, maybe your picture looks completely different now and your aspirations and your goals and your dreams are completely different than what they were 5 years ago. And that's fine. And it's great because you've got the opportunity to pivot. And because you've had a good plan to date, you can carry on with that plan. And it's not all, you know, it's not this overwhelming well, there's nothing left for me to do feeling, I think, that a lot of people have when things like this come across their path.
Nicole, thank you very much indeed. Nicole Funden-Munkhoff, certified financial planner from Independent Securities with Personal Finance this evening. Some really good, solid, sage, strong guidance and advice. Because for so many people, I get lots of emails from people saying, well, you know, it's all well and good you talking about this fact that we should be investing, but I didn't and I'm stuck and I don't know what to do. My friend, who shall remain nameless, is making up for lost time and doing very well at it, by the way. But yes, more detail on that, I think, because I think it's a valuable conversation to have.